Okay, which one here? Yeah, so like David said, I'm a first year PhD student. So my background was I did an undergrad in neuroscience and chemistry and philosophy minors. And then I did a master's in biomedical engineering. During my master's, I worked in connectomics, which is this subfield of neuroscience that's all about mapping connections between brain regions. And so it's this sort of growing subfield and big focus in neuroscience right now. And so when I was done with my master's, I worked in industry for 2 years. I worked at a startup that was doing machine learning for drug development. So we did we built tools for precision medicine. So better if anyone knows what an oligonucleotide is, oligonucleotide therapies. And so then I got really interested in interpretability, started reading a bunch of papers in this field on the side and sort of getting to know, who's publishing where and stuff. And so that's how I ended up reaching out to David and joining the lab and starting a PhD. So so today I'm going to be talking about something a little bit out of distribution for our meetings, which is I'm calling it a whirlwind tour of statistical learning on graphs. So the background for this, so for anyone who doesn't know, this is a textbook that we just finished in like early September, right as I was starting my PhD. We have a publishing contract with Cambridge University Press, and so it's out for copy editing with Cambridge right now. And so it should be in full book form in I don't know how long. It's pretty unclear. Maybe like 8 months, a year. They've been pretty, high variance about when it's actually happening. But the background behind this book was basically so like I said, I was in this field of neuroscience called connectomics. This field sort of got started in the 80s when you have these little roundworms called C. elegans, and they have tiny little nervous systems with only about 300-ish neurons, 305. And so they were the first animal to have their entire nervous system fully mapped out. So all of the which neurons connect to which other neurons is fully traced. Where the neurons are is completely mapped out. You can go online, you can browse all the different neurons and look at their connections and all this other stuff. And so that sort of spawned this growing movement to like move up the animal tech tree. So recently, there's been this big effort to map out the fly brain. And so that's, way harder than 300 neurons. It spurred all the development of techniques in connectomics for automating the process of tracing neurons in 3D. So there's all this kind of research coming out of this area in service of this effort. And then one of the research areas is can you once you have a brain mapped out and you can you view it as a graph, right? So you have a bunch of neurons, they have connections with other neurons, and so that's just naturally lends itself to like a graph structure, right? Where neurons are nodes and white matter connections are edges. And so the group that I worked on oops, the group that I worked with was really not involved in the biology side of things at all. It was really involved in the developing statistical techniques to work with graphs. Once you have a connectome that that's usable. Sort of the surrounding group. This was at Johns Hopkins, and we worked with the statisticians in the math department and in the computer science department. And so it was this joint effort for like 10 years. We also had University of Chicago and University of Illinois, someone at UT Austin, a lot of people sort of co-publishing for many years. And so it created this body of research that became big enough that it was worth turning into a textbook. So this idea of writing a textbook was sort of floating around the lab. And then me and one of the PhD students in the lab at the time, Eric Bridgeford, just said like, let's do it. Let's just like sit down and start writing it. And so that became my master's thesis. Eric and I kept working on it. After I graduated, I stopped for like 6 or 7 months, and Eric just kept going. And then I hopped back on it, and we got our publishing contracts, and yeah. So that's the background behind how this happened. So I just want to start out. So the structure of this talk is going to be, I'm just going to pull out this sort of like really central concept that we developed throughout the first half of the textbook, and just sort of explain it in the first half of this talk. And then the second half is going to be, how can you take this and apply it in lots of different application areas, and sort of expand on it, and what other techniques can you find to learn stuff about networks. So and we also made the decision to call graphs networks instead of graphs, because we didn't want people getting confused with plots. We just
No.
didn't like the word graph, because, you know, but then we also have the problem that a network is also a neural network. So, you know, it's the same boat anyway. So, but yeah, so I just want to start out by, you know, defining a little bit what I mean when I say network. So here's an example of sort of a pretty standard network, and there's a few questions that you can ask about it, right? So you have nodes here, and you have edges between nodes, but this network has a little bit of structure. So you have two communities. In this example, it's two schools, and so it's Facebook friend connections between with two schools. And it's just like a subgraph of that. And so you can see here that most of this friend group in the first school, they're part of this first community. There's another friend group in the second community, you know, and then there's this outlier node here. So, you know, in our example, maybe, you know, this is Northeastern and this is MIT. And then, you know, there's someone who likes to go to the, I don't know, this is Harvard, and there's someone who likes to go to the Harvard AI safety, you know, thing. And so then they make friends with a bunch of the Harvard AI safety people, right? So, so some questions you could ask is, you know, if you didn't know this community structure in advance, how could you find it, right? Or another question you could ask is, you know, how do I find, how do I find out what this outlier node is, and how do I even discover that this is an outlier node without knowing the community structure in advance? And so there's other questions that you can ask once you have more than one network, right? So for instance, if you had a bunch of different brain networks of musicians, you could say, can I classify brain networks into musician brains and non-musician brains? So in this case, it's a classification task, and you give a binary node label to each network. And so there's some interesting work in connectomics that shows that if you have MRI scans and you build networks out of those MRI scans, you can predict some properties with you know, non-chance accuracy. So for instance, you can predict gender with you know, not 100% accuracy, but certainly far, far beyond chance. So there's a lot of you know, sort of promising work in this. There's another you know, in another situation, you might have node features. So you know, you have your network, it has its topology, but then you also might have, for every node, you might have a vector of features, right? So if it's our school example, each person might be associated with, like, I don't know, their height and their age and whatever, right? And so you would like some ways to incorporate these node features into your learning methods. So so that's another situation that can pop up. There's a lot more situations. So you know, you can have directed networks, you can have edge weights, you can have nodes with edges to themselves, you can have like multiple connected components. You can go crazy and say that like nodes can have multiple edges with each other, whatever. But we're just going to focus on like the really simple case of you have an unweighted undirected network. You know, there's no self loops, there's nothing weird. It's just like a really standard network. And so the way that you represent this usually is with this adjacency matrix. So just, you know, so that we're comprehensive, the way that an adjacency matrix works is You have this network here, and you give an index to every node. And then for pairs of nodes that have an edge in them, you put a one in the row and column corresponding to that edge. So here you have row one and column two, and there's an edge there. So there's a one in row two and column one. So I actually had that reversed, but yeah. So that's how the adjacency matrix works. The issue that you run into in real life a lot of the time is that the network that you see isn't actually a perfect representation of the network that you would like to see. So, you know, this is sort of what statistics is all about. You get this noisy draw from the distribution that you actually care about. And so, so you might have missing nodes, you might have missing edges. You know, if you're getting multiple networks, you might be missing like an entire one of the networks, right? So the way that we want to frame investigation is we have this this network that we see, and it's just a sample from the distribution that we actually care about. So we're going to view networks as random variables. And so for anybody who hasn't taken probability, a random variable is essentially just a variable whose value depends on some probability distribution. That's like a pretty decent way to think about it. When I say networks are random variables, what I mean is that, so there's a case where you could say that the number of nodes is random, but let's just ignore that case. And let's say that the number of nodes is fixed, but the edge probabilities between pairs of nodes is not fixed, or it's not fixed. And so when we see a network, what we're actually seeing is that every edge is sampled with a probability. And so so the way that you define this rigorously is you have this probability matrix that's the same size as your adjacency matrix, but instead of there being ones and zeros in each place, there's probabilities between zero and one, and then you just sample from this probability matrix to observe a network. And so so the object that you really care about is this probability matrix, and that's sort of what you're trying to get at. And one way of viewing this that's sort of nice is that if you got really, really sure about what your probabilities were. So you kind of took the limit and you said, I'm 100% sure in my observation that every edge is going to be there every single time if I observed a new network. Then the probability matrix just collapses into being the adjacency matrix because every edge probability is just one. You know, that's in the, we're ignoring edge weights right now, but that's like kind of a good way to think about it. So there's a lot of different probability distributions that you can define on network valued random variables. So the most brain dead simple one is you can just say every edge is going to be sampled with some probability, and they're all going to be sampled with the same probability. So this is called an Eratosthenes network. And so in this case, all you're saying is, every edge is sampled with a 30% probability. And then you have the symmetry, right? Because you have undirected networks. You 30% probability here. Here you could say that every edge is sampled with a 70% probability. This case isn't that interesting because there's no structure to a graph that's sampled in this way. And so you want to get a little bit more interesting. And so taking our school example from before, we could say that instead of every edge being sampled independently with the same probability, we have a community structure. And so we're going to assign every node a community. And so we're going to have this vector of community assignments for each node. And then we're going to have this matrix that says for community one, any pair of nodes that are both in community one are going to have the same probability. And any pair of nodes that are in community two are also going to have the same probability. And for nodes that are in different communities, they're going to have a lower probability, right? So here, you know, students between different schools are going to have a probability of 10% of being friends. And in the first school, 60%, in the second school, 40%. So, you know, and so now that's kind of nice. We're getting a little bit more, we're building a bit more structure. And there's more stuff that you can do here, right? You can get pretty complicated with the types of distributions that you define on networks. So, so, you know, for instance, you could say that, what if we want to say that there's a bunch of popular kids in like school one? Or like there's one popular kid who has like on average, like way more friends than all the other kids. So, you know, you could, define networks, that account for that, right? You can do all kinds of crazy stuff. I'm not going to talk about any other network valued random variables, except that, I'm going to be focusing the rest of this talk on, this, network valued random variable that's called a random dot product graph. And so, these things are really useful. And so a lot of the theory that's been built around these types of network valued probability distributions is built around these random dot product graphs. And so, the way that this works, and this is going to actually be familiar to a lot of, deep learning people, is every node is associated with a vector. And so you have this, basically it's just an embedding matrix. That's the same as any embedding matrix that you would see, where the rows are nodes. And they live in some d-dimensional Euclidean space. And so the way that we're going to define our probability matrix is we're going to define an inner product space on this latent position matrix. And so we're going to say that the edge probability for any given pair of nodes is defined by their dot product. You know, there's a few constrictions that you need to make on the types of vectors that you can have, right? So their dot products need to be positive values, and they need to be between 0 and 1. But as long as you've constricted your space such that, you know, nodes in the space can only live in that part of the space, then you have a fully defined probability matrix by taking the XX transpose, right? So the dot product between every pair of rows. So now we're like kind of in business, because now we have this like embedding space that we can use to like try to understand networks. And it's the probability matrix is fully defined by this embedding space. So just rolling with this, say we have a real network. Well, actually there's one more thing I wanted to say. So, a really nice thing is that, if you view the magnitudes, if you just put every node on the unit sphere so that they have magnitude 1, the dot product is just the cosine of their angle, right? The cosine function is bound between negative 1 and 1. If you restrict where in the space they're allowed to be, then the cosine function is bound between 0 and 1. So you can think of the probabilities as just the cosine of their angle, if you want to view it like that. So that's sort of like just a really nice way to think about it. One result of that is that if you have high edge probabilities between pairs of nodes, then they're going to be closer together in this latent space, because the cosine of their angle their angle is higher, and so the cosine of their angle is they have a smaller angle with each other, right? So that's sort of like a really nice property of viewing things in this way. So just to recap, we want to understand things about networks. We want to understand things about the way that the probability distribution of networks works, the way that the distribution they're sampled from works. In order to do that, we've defined a probability matrix P, such that the ijth entry of P is the probability between pairs of nodes. And then we said the way that we want to define P is by giving each node a vector and saying that the dot product between vectors defines edge probabilities, right? So the big problem here is that if I have a real network, I don't know how to estimate this X thing, right? Like, you know, I'm given an adjacency matrix, first of all, not a probability matrix. And I want to figure out where in the embedding space these nodes live with just this adjacency matrix. And so what do I do? So it turns out that that you can do eigendecompositions, and you can estimate this latent space matrix. And so ignoring the adjacency matrix, let's stay on the probability matrix for a second. Let's say we take the eigendecomposition of the probability matrix, right? So so that's Q lambda Q transpose, where lambda is just a diagonal matrix of eigenvalues, right? And Q has columns that are the eigenvectors of the matrix. So for anyone who's like, you know, not, you know, linear algebra was like a long time ago or whatever, this really nice property of symmetric matrices, which remember is what P is because we're in the undirected situation. A nice property of symmetric matrices is that if you take their eigendecomposition, all of the eigenvectors are orthogonal to each other. And so that means that the matrix of eigenvectors is just a rotation matrix, right? And so you can take P, you can rotate it into the, and it turns into a matrix of eigenvectors. Another thing that you can do, because lambda is a diagonal matrix, is you can break it up into square roots. So you can say lambda is lambda to the 1/2 times lambda to the 1/2, right? There's you know, a few other light assumptions that you have to make about P here to make this fully defined, but they're very light, and that's okay. And then what we can do is we can just say, hey, I can use this property of matrix multiplication, and if I take the transpose of this thing, then this thing is just equal to this thing, right? They're the same object. And so if I just move this transpose to the outside here, and then flip them, you know, which is just a basic property of matrices, then you have this Q lambda to the 1/2 times Q lambda to the 1/2. Look, these things are the same value inside. Let's just call that X, right? And so I have this nice XX transpose here. And so now I've taken the eigendecomposition and used it to find this embedding matrix that we cared about. Yeah, Sheridan.
So didn't you say that we just have the adjacency, or where did we get the probability?
Yeah, so I'm getting to that. Okay. Yeah. So we're just like hallucinating that we had the probability matrix right now. And so because we're like, how do we get X? Well, okay, if I had the probability matrix, this is how I would do it. And then we're going to get into, well, I don't have the probability matrix, but, you know, what can we do anyway? But this is how we would get X if we had the probability matrix, right? and so the problem that Sheridan just brought up is that we don't actually have the probability matrix. We only have the adjacency matrix. And so what do we do? Well, you can still take decompositions. So you can, you know, A is still symmetric. It still has this orthogonal set of eigenvectors. And it turns out there's some other nice properties of matrix that shows that if you have a symmetric matrix and you decompose it, the set of singular vectors and singular values are almost the same as the set of eigenvectors and eigenvalues, except that you have this nice property of the singular value decomposition that everything is positive. So you have all positive eigenvalues, you have all positive, you know, everything is positive. And so you've sort of constrained your space so that it's nice in the way that we want, which is you're not going to accidentally get negative probabilities. You're not going to have negative eigenvalues, because the singular values are always positive. They're the absolute value of the eigenvalues. And so we're going to switch to using the singular value decomposition, which is basically the same. The eigenvectors are exactly the same, except there's just some flips of signs in various situations. What you can do now is you can take A, and you can just say A is actually an estimate of the probability distribution, right? Like we said before, that in the limit, A was equal to the probability distribution. And so it turns out that you can actually always view it as being an estimate of the probability distribution, an estimate of the probability matrix. There's a bunch of like statisticians who have proved a bunch of limit theorems and a bunch of like, you know, as you increase the number of nodes, how close you are of an estimate to P increases. And so there's all this theory around this that shows that you can do this. And so we're just going to take A. We're just going to take its singular value decomposition, and then we're going to just say we're going to say that our estimate of x is this left singular vector times the square root of its singular values. And by the way, we're going to because we don't think that that x is actually in a space that's equal to the number of nodes. Once we do that, we can just chop off the last, few columns, as many columns as we want, and say that it lives in a d-dimensional space. That was kind of a lot, but does anyone have questions? Yeah.
As a practical example, the problem that you try to solve here is you want to find some general properties of the brain, some probability distribution of how the neurons are connected,
mm-hmm.
but you only have one sample, which is A.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
now you want to generalize this one sample to a probability distribution.
Yeah, so it's not quite that. The real thing that we care about turns out to actually be x, because if you look at like here's an example of the nodes all plotted. When you look at the nodes, and I'll show you why it's useful to just try to find x directly. But when you, I mean, it has all the same usefulness as having embeddings does, right? You know, there's a reason that we turn sentences into embeddings and we try to find embeddings for everything, right? Finding X is sort of you do it for the same reasons, right? You can find community structures, you can run all these traditional algorithms on them. You can just do a lot more with objects that live in Euclidean space than you can with objects that live in like graph-valued space. So that's the real point, is where we actually care about finding this thing so that we can do downstream stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, you are finding x based on just one draw of A, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, how costly is to just take multiple draws of A?
Well, you don't have the probability matrix.
If you draw multiple draws of A, then you have the probability matrix.
Right, but it depends on the setting, right? If A is found by painstakingly going through, you know, a fly brain and getting every single neuron over the course of 5 years, then it's a lot harder to draw multiple A's, but if A is like, you know, an attention head that you've symmetrized, then it's pretty easy.
So you only need to do this analysis if drawing A is super costly, right? Otherwise, you could just draw like 10,000 A's and then you have the probability matrix and then you have the X.
Yeah, but you would do this. Yeah, but you would do the same thing either way, right? Because with a probability matrix, under the assumptions that I'm making, the assumption I'm making is called... you're assuming that the probability matrix is a positive semi-definite matrix, meaning that all of the eigenvalues are positive. Mm-hmm. So if you, under that assumption, the SVD is the same thing as the eigenvalue decomposition. So you'd do the same thing either way. You would always just find its singular vectors.
If you only have one A, there are like certain values, like you have either ones or zeros in mm-hmm. your agency matrix, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So literally two nodes, if they have an edge, they're literally the same because their dot product is one, right?
No, because, what do you mean two nodes are the same if they, because you have to look at the whole, you have to look at all of the nodes that
okay.
Right?
Yeah.
So like one node isn't just connected to one other node. It's connected to like however many others.
Hmm. Yes.
If you had two isolated nodes, then they would have the exact same mm-hmm. latent position. And it turns out that, if you have, you know, this community structure that I talked about before, if two nodes are pulled from the same community, then if you had the probability matrix, their latent positions would be the same in that case, right? Because all of the edge relationships between them and other nodes all have the same probabilities. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you're not actually in the, like, I only have one sample situation that you would imagine that you are, because it turns out that if you increase the number of nodes in your adjacency matrices, you get better estimations. So so it's like, yes, the adjacency matrix is just one object, but if you have a bunch of nodes, then you're in better shape. So, yeah.
So I've got nerdy technical questions.
Yeah.
Can you go back to your SVD?
Yeah.
So there's, I guess I have two questions. So one's conceptual and the other is technical. So the one is, we'll go to the next one.
Which one? This one?
Algorithm.
Which one? This
yeah,
one?
The algorithm. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Sure.
So, okay. So one of them is, what happened to the V?
Because
that's just a technical question.
Yeah.
And then the more conceptual question is, so if you have this embedding,
mm-hmm.
does it totally capture the original A? Like can you recover the A from it, or have you lost something? Or another way of looking at it is, if you have this nice embedding, like, you know, if you, I think David's in this situation, right? If you have two different, you know, networks,
mm-hmm.
where you might have shuffled the nodes.
Yeah,
in one of them.
I'm gonna do that. Yeah,
oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I have a method for helping that.
But the X thing, what happened to the B?
So remember that A is always gonna be symmetric, and so you're always gonna have orthogonal singular vectors and orthogonal singular values. And the only difference between the SVD of A and the eigenvalue decomposition of A is the signs on the singular values.
So the V is the same as U except for some signs.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. So we could do the same thing with B instead of U.
I see. But then is X transpose equal to A, or is it
XX transpose is equal to A. But you see what we're doing here is we're saying so we let U epsilon be U sigma V transpose be the left singular vectors, the singular values, and the right singular vectors. And so we're gonna say UD isn't the original U, but it's the matrix whose rows are the first D left singular vectors and the diagonal matrix whose entries are the first D singular values. So we're deleting some of the singular vectors, right? The same way you would in PCA. And so you can't fully reconstruct, but if you delete the singular vectors corresponding to the lowest singular values, you lose provably as little information by mean squared error loss as you can possibly lose.
I see. But if you set D equals to N, then you can reconstruct.
Then you can totally recover it. Yeah.
I see. Okay.
Yeah. Yep. And then, wait, what was your second question again?
That's it. Those are the questions.
Okay, great.
Oh, I have a question.
Yeah.
So, in an essence, you're trying to find an X.
Yes.
That's basically...
Estimate X, yeah.
Yeah, the estimated X mm-hmm. is... You're trying to form a basis directions that would map all your connections such that anywhere you have a connection, they're all clustered together, aligned in the same direction.
Mm-hmm.
And the nodes that are not aligned should be perpendicular to each other.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
What's the motivation for that? Why are you going for that? Like, I think this all started when you said, I want my probability to be an inner product of my X.
Mm-hmm.
Why that motivation?
The motivation is actually the reverse of that. So the motivation is actually, I want to turn my network into vectors in Euclidean space. So that's the real motivation. And it turns out that going in the direction of starting from your X and defining an inner product space on it to be the probability matrix, it turned out to be the way to go in reverse and start with an adjacency matrix and get an estimate of X. And because it turns out that the estimate of X is just really useful in and of itself for a lot of downstream applications, because now you've gone from a network that's really hard to deal with and you have all these dependencies between nodes and you have like, no one really knows how to like, you know, there's some weird, like, you know, you can like do algorithms that involve like walking along the graph and other stuff, but like you're very limited. Whereas if you take the whole thing and you just put it into Euclidean space and you have like some strong theoretical reason to do so, then there's all these things that you can do with nodes that live in Euclidean space. So that's your motivation. It's you actually just want to get X.
So it's like you want a semantic structure
mm-hmm. yeah.
of your latents.
Yeah, yeah, right, yeah, yeah. You're trying to find node structure. And I'll give a bunch of examples in the second half of the presentation for why this is useful to do. Yeah.
Sorry. And the size of your embedding will be the number of nodes.
Right? The number of rows in the embedding. Yeah.
So D. D.
D.
Oh, D. No. No. So you. If you were to set D equal to N, then the embedding would just be a square matrix. But in practice, what you do is the same as you do in PCA, where you pick some number of low singular vectors to just delete because you don't care about them because they don't give you any information.
But D is the size of your embedding.
D is the size of your embedding, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, and you pick D. There's methods to pick D, right? So you can look at the scree plot, right, of singular values, and you can look at the elbow point where it drops off a lot. But yeah, D is the size of your embedding.
So for the embeddings that you're, I kind of forgot what so if they have an inner product of, or like a dot product of one versus mm-hmm. zero, what's like an in-between value mean? So does zero mean they're like not connected?
Zero means there's a 0% probability of there being an edge between those two nodes. Okay. So if in your inner product space, or sorry, if in your embedding space, then the two nodes, so think of them as points in Euclidean space now. If in your embedding space, the new two nodes are fully orthogonal to each other, then that means that they have an edge probability of zero. And if the two nodes are exactly on top of each other, then that means that they have an edge probability of one. And so they're guaranteed to have an edge with each other, right? And so as they rotate away from each other in Euclidean space, their edge probability drops until you hit orthogonality. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah.
How much does magnitude matter in that space? I guess if we go to high dimensions, then cosine similarity, like...
Yeah, so I mean, it's you're always using the dot product, right? So you're always using, right? You're always taking the magnitude of the first times the magnitude of the second times the cosine of their angle. There's people who study what this space has to look like to guarantee that the dot product is one. It's called the probability simplex, and you get to a pretty limited space as you increase the number of dimensions. You basically just define it so that vectors can only live in the space where they're guaranteed to have an inner product with each other between zero and one.
So in the general case, you don't constrain yourself to like only the unit sphere.
What do you mean by the general case?
Like your algorithm doesn't output x's that are on a unit sphere.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Yeah. But there's because of all of because of the theory that shows that as you increase the number of nodes of an adjacency matrix, it gets closer to the probability matrix. They get closer and closer to that. So they get closer to the probability simplex as you increase the number of nodes, it turns out. Okay. So you end up being fine. And it also turns out that if you like loosen that restriction a little bit, right, and they're like a bit off the probability simplex, it's fine. Like you can still do a bunch of useful stuff with X, like it's fine. So you could be anal about it, or you could just say we have a good way to get embeddings, right? So
Alex, last question.
Yeah.
Can you go back to your algorithm?
Yeah.
It seems like your X approximate is perpendicular.
Mm-hmm. Right? It's an orthogonal matrix, right? They're all orthogonal to each other. That's what you're saying?
The columns are.
Exactly. So mm-hmm. Does that mean you've mapped all your points into like orthogonal space?
You've mapped the axes into an orthogonal space. So the axes of the space are orthogonal, but the points themselves are the rows. And the rows aren't orthogonal. They're not, the rows aren't guaranteed to be orthogonal, only the columns.
So U1 and U2 should be perpendicular to each other, right? In the left SVD matrix.
The columns.
Yeah, U1 and U2 are perpendicular to each other. Yeah. Yeah, all the columns are orthogonal.
But the embeddings are the rows.
Yeah, the embeddings are the rows. Make sense? Cool. Okay. Oof.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Wow. Wow. Yeah. Okay. I have like way more presentation. I'm only in the first third, but it's 10:50. So we're gonna skip to some applications. Okay. So one application is uncovering a human trafficking network. Right. So let's imagine that. Actually, that's cheating. You guys are going to see what happens. So let's imagine that you have a bunch of web pages, and those web pages are advertisements. And in each of those advertisements, there's like a phone number, and there's like, you know, like an address, and then there's some other stuff, right? But you have some way to define like connections between web pages, and you know that some of the web pages are human traffickers, and you're the police, and you want to find all the other human traffickers. So what do you do? One thing that you can do is you can set up your adjacency matrix the way that I just described, do your SVD the way that I just described. And then you can say for my human trafficker nodes, I'm going to take their locations and average all the locations. And so then this star is the average human trafficker location in my embedding space. And so to find other human traffickers, I'm going to look for other nodes, other web pages that are close to this little star. And I'm going to find their k-nearest neighbors. And then the ones that are closest to the star, those ones are the most suspicious. So I'm going to go investigate those people because I want to find more human traffickers. And so you can run like k-means or Gaussian mixture model to find communities, right? And so, you know, you could find human traffickers in this way. If you have features for each node, the situation I talked about before. So say we're in a situation where we have a network, right? It's this, we have Wikipedia pages, and we have a graph of computer science and statistics Wikipedia pages, and there's an edge between them if they link to each other. And let's just ignore directedness like normal. So you have an undirected network. But there's this problem, which is that there's a few computer science pages and a few statistics pages that are really, really highly connected with everything. And so you have this core periphery structure where you have like a few web pages, a few Wikipedia pages that are like not that high edge weights with anything, and a few that are like really dense. And what you want to do is you want four communities. You want the dense and not dense community, and then you want the computer science and statistics community. And so you have these covariates, right? So for each web for each Wikipedia page, you also have whether it's a statistics or a computer science page. And so what you can do is you can just take its adjacency matrix and take these covariates, take their the YY transpose of these covariates, scale that. In practice, you actually turn A into this other structure called the Laplacian. It's just a function of the adjacency matrix. And then they look like this. You can take their weighted sum. And then as you change the weight, you see here, you only have the core periphery structure. Here, you only have the computer science versus statistics. But as you increase the edge weight, you can find a weight that divides them into four groups. So, so that's sort of like, and then you can classify, and that's sort of like a nice thing. There's ways to automatically find the edge weight. So there's other methods. So if I have a lot of different networks, then what I would like is to put them all into the same space, because I want to be able to directly compare all of their nodes. And so the reason why you can't just take them all and do this adjacency matrix thing separately and then just compare it like that is that you run into this problem of rotation. So if you have a bunch of points and you rotate them all, and then you take the inner product of those points, then it's the same. So if I have these two points and they have some dot product, and then I rotate the two points, their dot product is invariant for that rotation. And so that means that there's actually a lot of different X's that can make a single probability matrix because you can rotate. And so you can show this algebraically by just sticking an identity matrix inside here, expanding it into two orthogonal matrices, doing that transpose trick that I did before. And look, it's like a totally new set of two matrices. So this is called rotational invariance. And so one way that you can fix that is you can take each network and put them as block diagonals into this big matrix. And then you can, on the odd diagonals, you put their averages. And so there's a bunch of theory that was built around what happens if you do this. And it turns out that if you do this, you get a bunch of stacked latent positions, right, in this SVD of this this big block matrix that you've made. And if you just take a bunch of rows out, then now you have a bunch of embeddings that are all rotationally on top of each other. So you have this sort of like nice, you can compare them directly now. So another thing that you can do if you have multiple networks is you can say, hey, I have this central latent structure, but I still want to preserve some distance, some differences between networks, right? Like they're different in some fundamental way, but they have this common shared structure and the same number of nodes and whatever. And so for that, you can say, instead of my probability matrix being XX transpose, you can say my probability matrix is going to be defined by SS transpose, this single shared matrix that's shared between all of them. But each network is going to get its own little matrix R that defines how it's different from all the other matrix. So you have this shared structure, but then you also have it's called a score matrix that makes each network different from each other network. and you can define P like this. And this is some intuition, but I'm going to skip it. And you can estimate this by taking a bunch of adjacency matrices, running SVD on them, concatenating all of those, and then running SVD again. And then what you get is an estimate of this S, and then you can find R, and you have your estimate of P, and you can find R by just doing some simple algebra on it for each network. So there are ways to deal with multiple networks. You can also, if you have rotations, there's this classic algorithm called the orthogonal Procrustes that just takes two embeddings. And this is just true in general. You can take two embeddings and then you can run this minimization where you find the rotation matrix that best puts them on top of each other, right? So you find the best rotation matrix. And so there's this iterative method to find this. And so the situation you just you mentioned is so a lot of the time, if I have multiple adjacency matrices, if I have the same set of nodes on each adjacency matrix, the indices that you give each node is like completely arbitrary a lot of the time. And so what will happen is you have like two networks, but you don't know the correspondence between the nodes. Because the index that you came up with is like arbitrary and you've like measured them and you don't know which nodes correspond to which other nodes. So this is a very classic problem. It's called graph matching, right? So if I take this adjacency matrix and I scramble it, I just scramble the indices, then, it still has this community structure. And it turns out if you take the SVD and you estimate this X, you would still find the community structure in this one. So that's really important. It's another reason why it's useful to do this SVD thing. But just looking at the adjacency matrix, you get like nothing out of this. And so this is a classic problem called graph matching. It works by getting estimations of these permutation matrices. Permutation matrix just shuffles around rows and columns. So you can shuffle around both the rows and the columns with this, right? So this is a symmetry transformation. It preserves eigenvalues, but just moves everything into a new basis. So this is just permuting the adjacency matrix. And so you can set up this minimization problem where you say, I have this adjacency matrix. I have this other adjacency matrix. I want to find the permutation matrix that best maps the two matrices onto each other. And the restriction is the P is a permutation matrix. And so there's this method called fast quadratic approximation that does this in this iterative way. And I won't get into the details because it's a bit complicated, but there's nice functions set up to do that. And then another example situation is say I have two networks. And what I want to say, what the only thing that's different about these two networks, they have different probability matrices, but those probability matrices are almost the same. But there's some subgraph in the probability matrix, and that subgraph is the only place that defines the differences. So most of the edge connections are drawn from the same distribution, but there's the subgraph that's a different distribution. And so that's called a signal subnetwork. There's ways to estimate what that signal subnetwork is using hypothesis testing methods. So there's There's an easy way with you have a bunch of networks. You can do a hypothesis test on each edge because you have a lot of them. You get p-values and then you rank the p-values. The problem with that is that you're not actually using the structure of the adjacency matrix. And so you can do this sort of iterative thing where you find the p-values, you delete the nodes that connect to edges with low p-values, and then you run the thing again. And now you're finding signal nodes and you're only running the thing on signal nodes. And so now you're taking advantage of graph structure. And so there's an algorithm to do that. There's a lot of other stuff that we cover. We have an end-to-end project in the second chapter. There's all kinds of properties that nodes can have, right? Their degree, which is the number of connections with other nodes, summary statistics on networks, pre-processing techniques you can do, a lot of other statistical models that I didn't talk about, what the Laplacian matrix that I mentioned is and why it would be useful to use that sometimes instead of the adjacency matrix, sparsity properties. This is a situation where if you get an embedding, it's pretty computationally intense to do SVD a single time. So you might not want to do that if you have just one new node that you want to add to your graph. So you can estimate where that node should be in the embedding space. If you have like a bunch of networks and you want to find an anomalous one, you can use hypothesis testing methods to do that. And then we have a chapter on graph neural networks and on random walk methods. I kind of had to speed up a little bit there at the end, but that's okay. So that's kind of like I think the finding some estimate of X is like kind of one of the core ideas, and then there's like a lot of theory built around like stuff that you could do once you've done that. Anyone have any questions? Okay, cool. Yeah. The other thing that David mentioned is I should probably bring up, since I have everybody in the room, David and I have been brainstorming, project ideas. And so, he brought up that I should probably talk about project ideas. I didn't want to bring up like, what the potential ideas are for projects because it's pretty half-baked and like I haven't actually done much yet, but the idea right now is to kind of build off of this idea of influence functions. So you want some method that tells you how much influence a single training data point has on the output of like some language model. And and so we've sort of been investigating that. There's this paper that that Shen Yu at Carnegie Mellon came out with that can do this with that uses like this unlearning based method to kind of get at this problem from another way. But that's sort of like what we're starting on. And so. I don't really know what to say about it.
So this is so I love people's feedback on this. So you'll be because Alex and I have been brainstorming about this project one on one, and you guys generally know what each other are doing in research, but nobody knows what Alex is doing yet because it's just started first year. Welcome.
Yeah.
And so there's sort of a little bit of a blind spot in our research in this area, and it seemed like something that Alex is potentially interested in, which is just this training data attribution problem. And it's this holy grail of machine learning because it's really not well solved. There's only been a few papers that have really taken it on seriously, and which is just generally the question of you have some output behavior of your network, what did it come from? What training data explains this behavior the most? Some people have noticed that, large language models will memorize their output. They'll regurgitate articles from the New York Times And it seems obvious that, oh, well, I must have learned it from reading that article in the New York Times. But you know, often you'll have a network do something clever and you'll wonder, you know, where did it learn that clever thing from? And so, you know, some people are worried about this for copyright reasons and things like this. But, you know, so there's like sort of two or three questions. We came up with this problem setting, which I don't know if you guys think is compelling or not. Do you want to explain the possible problem setting?
Yeah. So we were thinking of looking at like code LLMs. And so, you know, so we were thinking, you know, say you, you know, have an LLM generate some code and, you know, and it has a bug and you get some attribute error. And so, you know, one thing that you would kind of like is to explain, you know, why if you could go back to the training data and figure out why, you know, why this bug is happening, right? Another, you know, potentially useful thing that you could do is like, you know, you generate some code, you know, it has some error or whatever, and then you can go into the documentation that is most similar to the code that it wrote. And so then you can just immediately go into documentation from wherever you are, and it's documentation that it was in its training data. So then you have this sort of like extra layer of information on top that lets you kind of understand what's going on.
So I'm sort of into this setting because it's, you know, there's this theme of like human learning, right? You know, like the models are doing things that people are learning from. And the code LLMs is like sort of one of these settings, like where people are like using the code LLMs to try to navigate technical abilities that they're trying to learn from the things. Like they might be trying to learn a new programming language or something like that. And so they're always faced with the situation of like, well, it did this clever thing. I don't know if I should believe it or not. You know, is there something else I can read about it? It's like the citation problem, right? It's like, oh, you know, maybe you'd like to know where it is that the code LLM got this idea that it's trying to tell you to do. And you can go read the original sources and get some more context, you know, maybe as a way of connecting to the original human beings that gave the LLM the idea in the first place, right? And so I kind of, so this is the setting that we're brainstorming. I think that like maybe code LLMs is where one of the situations where it comes up cleanest. I don't know if anybody else has a setting where data attribution, you know, might work really well. Yeah.
Does this sound like model inversion attacks in computer vision?
Or MIA, like, or also known as membership inference attack. Yes. Yes. So this is a more general, you could argue harder, maybe easier problem. Membership inference attack is asking the question, you know, can I tell if a particular piece of training data was present in training or not? So like that's usually the obsession of privacy people, right? Like, oh, I want to know if my private data was in there. You know, I have this secret piece of medical record history that I don't want anybody to know my medical secret. And I want to go back to this medical birth that they just released on the internet and see if they trained on my secret data that I don't want them to know. And so it's very closely related, but this is different. This is more like, hey, the model said something. Maybe I know what all the training data was. Maybe the training data is public. Maybe it's like all the code in the world or something. Maybe all the code on GitHub. But I want to know like where the model got this idea that, you know, that makes sense.
Yeah. So code LLMs does not learn to code by looking at the documentations. It learns to code by looking at the codes. Right. So how does this?
Yeah, code LLMs. I mean, because like code contains a lot of comments and things like that.
So, one question is: what if there does not exist documentation that relates to the particular code? What would your project spit out in that instance? Would it just be like a 404? Would it try to generate documentation, or
Oh, well, you would want like a ranking of what the most similar training data is. So in that case, if there's no exact, you know, I mean, there might not be exact documentation, but there might be code that was written that's pulled from GitHub that's like really similar to the code that it wrote.
Yeah.
So then it might pop out that, for instance.
And then one, I don't know if this is, I'm fairly naive to this, but I guess another setting I can envision is in reinforcement learning, like why did the car turn left? Or like, is there any sort of training data or video that sort of explains an agent's actions, basically?
Yeah, maybe. Maybe like reinforcement learning could be an interesting setting. Yeah, that's another area that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what all the self-driving companies are doing now under the hood. I don't know if they're still doing a lot of reinforcement learning or if everything is just transformers now and the tokens, that the things that they're trying to predict are like actions based on frames or something. Yeah.
I gave self-driving cars as an example, but from my understanding, or like the FDA is sort of looking into AI as a potential area for pharmaceutical innovation. And if we're going to train models on like how a drug is manufactured, like we have to be able to understand why a model sort of made the decision to stir faster, like a beaker or something, to make sure that it doesn't have an impact on product quality. So I was thinking more from the manufacturing side of things, but like self-driving is sort of the more.
That's right. I think that, you know, the one of the motivations for the project is, you know, our theme is explainability, right? Interpretability of AI. A lot of the, like a very, very common question when people ask, you know, why did the AI do this? They sort of want to know, what was it in the training data that made it do this, right? This is like one of the forms that people, and the answer up to now that machine learning has presented is, we don't know why. Or you can run influence functions, but it would take 700 years for you to, you know, compute the Hessians or something like that. And then you're not really sure if it's very good.
But, yeah.
One natural setting where this arises, jurisdictional or judge decisions.
Yeah.
Because they often refer to
precedent.
Yeah.
Maybe legal texts.
Right.
Legal texts. And they often refer to like previous court decisions, right?
Yeah. Yeah, because you have like a really strong goal there. Like you want the court decisions to refer to, like if it comes up with a court decision, you want it to refer to all of the relevant cases. Yeah.
Yeah, and oftentimes a court decision just says, oh, we're very exactly to the same thing 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. And 10 years ago, they made that decision. That's why like the AI court decisions are not so relevant, because they will be the first ones that will inform future decisions.
Yeah,
it's very interesting. Yeah, legal text might be a good say.
So yeah, I mean, one thing that David and I were thinking about is that, you know, if this ended up looking like some vector search thing, right, where you have like a vector database and then you have some method to figure out the most influential vectors given the text that you just spit out, there's a bunch of companies all working on like vector databases and like retrieval and that kind of thing. So there's a lot of infrastructure being built up for it right now. So, you know, so that's sort of a nice to have kind of thing, right? Yeah.
If you like want to build up on the legal thing, there were like workshops on in the SEM eval about the legal evaluation thing. There were like tasks about it that they like give the public data, and there were, one of the tasks was actually to give the reasons on why they made the explanation. So there's like already like some build up code on that workshop. So that might be useful.
Cool. Okay. Yeah.
So I don't think I have like a suggestion on a setup.
Yeah.
Something which I'd be careful about your designing is, like most of the data attribution methods right now, at least in diffusion models, would give some sort of a function or like a score,
mm-hmm.
saying this could be the reason why, like this is the training sample which influenced my output.
Right.
But if you use the same function on an image which was not in the training data set,
mm-hmm.
but which is very closely related to the output,
mm-hmm.
it would still give like a very high attribution to it.
Yeah, right.
So like my question is, is that really attributing training sample, or is it really looking at like similarity scores?
That's a good question, because then, I mean, it's very easy for it to just collapse into building a similarity metric, which there's already a lot of.
Yeah, so, probably I'd put more thought in.
Yeah.
Like, how do I separate those two things?
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
You've read Chinese work, right? Yeah. So like they're you know, sort of where they've landed is that this is like the practical framing, right? So like, you know, they're trying to predict the ground truth of how much training influence you have, but in a practical way. I mean, so that's how, I mean, you know, that's how they're measuring their accuracy. Yeah.
So I don't think
totally believe it.
Yeah, I don't think I'm convinced that it's training attribution. I think.
Okay. You think it's just another type of similarity metric?
Yeah,
it physically is. Yes.
Which it is. Yes. Yeah. I guess like I would wait for that one more experiment that says, oh, it is actually connected to the training statistics or the training. Mm-hmm. Which is currently like, I think the reason it's not there is because I think it's still hard to make it a practical design, like experiment on how you would test that.
It's just expensive.
Yeah.
It is very expensive.
You need to train a model.
Yeah. Yes. And I'm not sure if what we have right now is the right approximation for finding the training influence in compared to like, is it just the similarity?
Right. 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 Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah.
You know, what do you think of, since you've read Chinese, what do you think of the feasibility of this even as a goal? Right. As a goal, like, is it feasible to really
deconvolve the embedding and see?
Yeah. To say, you know, to actually answer the question. You know, this was the most influential training data in the entire data set. You know, you trained GPT-4 for 6 months on all the world's information, and you've compressed it down to, you know, a tiny fraction of the amount of data that you consumed in this, even after it's compressed, it's, you know, a terabyte of weights.
Yeah.
And then now it did something surprising. It output some piece of poetry in a weird style, and I want to know where it got this idea. Do you think that it's even feasible to identify accurately? I mean, so doing the test of is it correct, isn't really possible to test, right? Because at least at large scale, right? Because, you know, you've got to rerun your training about 10 times. That would cost about $1 trillion or something. You know, it's like, you know, nobody's going to do that.
Yeah.
Right. And so, yeah. So does that mean this is outside of what we can do scientifically?
But I haven't thought about data attribution as much, but my current opinion is, yeah, maybe not.
Maybe it's outside.
Mm. But maybe you don't have to be as precise. Maybe it's fine enough to like have a set of like
candidate
two or three papers that were the most relevant. Or you have like a direct comparison metric of saying, okay, this legal text was more important than this legal text when doing the final decision.
Right. You know, like my opinion is that, you know, we're sort of in the same situation as like economists are when they're trying to give advice, right? You know, like, oh, we can't like rerun the entire economy, but we're trying to give advice about counterfactual situations of what would happen if you raised taxes or something like this, right? And so, you know, we can come up with our models that we can validate on smaller settings. We can retrain and test, you know, true data attribution on smaller settings where we can do the training.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just have to extrapolate and say, well, you know, our best guess is if these methods continue to work on the large settings. Right. I think that's, you know, and then we'll just have to present, you know, like when we get there, we'll have to present it with the right caveats.
I think like some of the current data attribution methods test that they do it on a small setup, they retrain and check how the scores are turned out.
Yes.
My only point on that is that I don't think we are really disentangling what has been learned versus how similar is the output to that current example.
You don't think that naturally those are like one would, there's a relationship between those two things, right? Like what you learned is probably to copy this sample. And so if the output is similar to the sample, then it's probably most similar to the things that, right?
No, that's probably most likely that's the case, but like—
Right.
How do we disprove basically that it actually is spitting out a relevance or an attribution? How would we basically go about proving, no, this is actually incorrect and this is not an attribution?
Well, so you can only do this in some of the controlled settings, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where you have a small network that you can retrain without that training data.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you do it and you pull the training data out and it didn't actually influence, the output as much as you thought it would, then your method is wrong.
Yeah, okay.
Canary injection.
What did you say?
Like a canary injection, maybe with that training data as well.
How does a canary injection work?
Like let's say you add some like special token or something with that data and just see whether that particular data point what was used.
Yeah, like you put in something really weird, like a hash code, like a big hash code or something, and you see the extent to which that hash code can be rediscovered.
Yeah. See, that's more like the security approach, right? This is the MIA community worrying about these things. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But is it of value to demonstrate that it is not a feasible task?
Is it of value to—
As in basically, like, if you can demonstrate that this actually isn't something that can fruitfully occur, like you can't actually extract things. If you can't actually attribute a particular training data to an output, is that still worth it to sort of like look at and see if, you know?
I think that if you were to be able to prove an impossibility theorem or something like that, that would be a good contribution.
Exactly. That's sort of what I was thinking.
But I'm not sure that people believe. Yes, that's one of the questions. Because, you know, there's a bunch of literature that suggests, the influence function literature, right, suggests, here's what an idealized solution would be.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just very expensive to compute. It involves something like the square, a single step of the iteration involves, computations on the order of solving matrix problems, where the matrix is the size of the square of the number of parameters of model. So if you have a, trillion parameter model, then that's a trillion, trillion, like you can't solve these problems.
Okay.
And so, but because it's, there's sort of these formulations out there that are sort of unsolvable, then like, I'm not sure that you can prove an impossibility theorem. Just might be infeasible.
Just to add to that, like, again, I guess in the privacy world, there's like these data extraction attacks where like, you prompt something to the model, and then they're able to give out like, let's say 100 plus so tokens that clearly match like a data training data point that they were able to get. So like, at least for those cases, you can like easily show that it's done with the document.
And I think, so the other thing that I think is probably going to happen is I think people are going to become comfortable with an estimate on attribution, right? So, your internship company Adobe, and other companies like this they're going to start selling this as a product, right? Yeah, so they're going to socialize the world into the idea that we can estimate, even though it's not a guarantee, we can estimate attribution,
mm-hmm.
In different settings, and so I feel like it's an area that's worth studying academically instead of just letting people sell products, making claims, right?
So the thing that comes to my mind when Alex was pitching this is there's been some work on like grounding language model outputs with citations or something like that. So that might be like relevant for like code. Like maybe you don't care that it's actually coming from the training data.
Yeah.
But like, here's some similar codes to this. maybe it is like some kind of like semi fuzzy matching to attribution. Like here's some code that was similar. This is helpful for thinking about why this LLM output this code or something.
Maybe it's okay that it's not attribution.
Yeah, I agree. Like instead of calling it, here's us attributing this to training data, we could like be more
like similarly, like if you look at like here, this neuron fires on a bunch of these kinds of texts, you're like, okay, well, I can kind of look at these texts and figure out, okay, yeah, it's firing on analogs or whatever. You can maybe pick out the pattern that way or something.
I mean, like, so like Perplexity has, you know, when you do like a search in Perplexity, for instance, it like cites a bunch of, you know, like, this is where I got this from, this is where I got that from. I have no idea how it's doing that. No,
Perplexity does reg.
It's some kind of vector database search thing.
I would guess so, yeah.
You think it's in reg?
It seems like most of the citation grounding is reg.
They have bots like Google and they support all the articles and websites that come in. They vectorize them, they rag them.
Yeah. I mean, the easiest way to do would just be have a vector database of like Google, and then you just like find the most similar, like the closest vectors in your vector space to the to the like sentence that the language model produced, right? And like we were saying before, like that would be easy to fall into, and that doesn't feel to me like research. Like I mean, like that's more of an engineering thing, I feel like, than like a research question of like how to do that.
Can I? I'll just give you a practical example of it. So, Adobe did try to include this data attribution into their pipeline to give artists royalties.
I see.
Based on how much Firefly is outputting art examples.
Mm-hmm.
The reason they couldn't do it is because an artist wasn't there in the training data. Art example and it gave
and
a high
score. I see, yeah.
And it's, so they were confused, like, how do we separate, is this a learned training artifact or is this something that the model is just thinking could be, you know, the influential.
Yeah.
So I like what Eric said, right? Instead of narrowing it down to this is training data attribution,
mm-hmm.
you could be more open about it and say, oh, these are probably grounding the output to these particular examples. These are the
inspiration.
So does it make sense to use attribution as the objective, as the framing? So like I kind of feel like you've got two possible goals, right? One is one goal is to answer the question, what citations should we provide that are most helpful to a user, which is interesting, but that I feel like that is a whole that brings us down the whole path of user studies and understanding, human perceptions, human behavior, human learning, right?
Yeah.
And then or the other possibility is to say, hey, we're going to give you the citations that are our estimate for what we think was the most informative for the model during its training.
That's a statement we can make. So
the second thing.
Yeah. Because if I give you a sample which is not in the training
but,
data.
But no, I understand. But like, but you can say that that's what we're modeling, that's the goal. Right.
No. I'm saying if a new sample, which is not in the training data, is still giving a higher score.
Yes.
Does that mean your method is really looking at the training influence, or is it looking at something else?
No, but you can say that you're modeling the, if it had been included, it would have been influential, right? You know what I mean? That it's an estimate.
Yeah.
Thanks, Lace, for coming, by the way.
Yeah, but I mean, you certainly couldn't use that for the royalties, which is what Adobe ran into, I guess.
Right. It's you can't use it for money.
Yeah.
Right. But there's these sort of two interesting objectives, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway, it's interesting. Because I feel like if you're on the other side and you're trying to optimize usability, then it's like you say, it's a little bit of an engineering thing. I mean, it's like, it can also be scientific, but we don't have access to a lot of this stuff. Like, I feel like if you're sitting on Google, then you can estimate usability by monitoring click streams and doing, you know, accessing these other data sources that as an academic lab we don't have access to, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting. Huh. Okay, that's food for thought.
Yeah, thanks, guys.
Thank you, Alex. Yeah, so that's great. Let's see. So next week is what's next week?
So we got NDI from Aaron Mollock.
Is next week November 1st?
Yes. Oh, my bad. Never mind. He's November 8th.
Right. So November 1st, actually, I'm out of town.
Yes.
Right. Because so I'm speaking at NYU. And so, but you guys should meet anyway. Just to, right. But, you know, but I just letting you know.
Yeah. So next week, we just have like India talk. Just like the feature updates. Next week, we have Arnab and Aaron Law.
Okay, cool.
I mean, yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Cool. Is there a talk coming up today?
No.
I think not. Yeah, we didn't have anything on the schedule.
Isn't that wild? It was a day where you don't have a talk at 10 and noon.
Yeah,
Arya was not able to.
I don't think so. I can check my chat here. I think that it ended up that Arya we didn't get.
No problem. That could be some other day.
Yeah.
Well, no,
right.
No one else at the moment right now. Okay. So all good for today.
Okay.
It's gonna be one.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll figure it out. Something for the students to think about. So like on NDIF, we're sort of trying to make a plan for what we're going to be doing for the next, you know, few years on the NDIF infrastructure project. And we have this spreadsheet that's in the NDIF, you know, chat channel, which is all these interpretability methods that we're going to make sure that NDIF supports really well on large networks. And so, you know, I can put the link to the spreadsheet out, but if you're interested in like what NDIF is gonna try to be good at and you have objections to that and you think, oh no, I think that NDIF should really be good at something different, then it's a good time to let us know and, you know, share your thoughts and that kind of thing, because, you know, we're really gonna manage a project you know, with these goals in mind, right? And we're trying to figure that out. Okay, thanks everybody.
What's the legal bookshelf or something like that?
You can write 70 now, I think that's SVM.